The Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
Hello, and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and today's podcast is all about a play called What's the Matter? And I'm delighted to be joined by Tristan Green and Sydney Robb of the Last Baguette Theatre Company. Tristan and Sydney, welcome to The Cosmic Shed.
Oh, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
So, what is What's the Matter?
It's a play about physics. It's a physical comedy aimed at adults and children.
And it's a silly comedy about a very serious subject.
What is that serious subject?
As far as I remember, quantum physics.
As far as you remember?
Yeah, sometimes I get a bit doubtful about it because we're talking to all these people about physics all the time and I'm like, oh God, am I going to say the wrong thing?
Right, okay. When you're making the show, are you thinking about an audience in particular?
Yeah, we try to make this for a family audience.
Yeah.
So it would be entertaining for adults and children.
Yeah. So it's like the idea is anyone who's sort of older than 8 will be happy to watch it.
Yeah,
and get maybe the idea that there's a proton and an electron and they are in some kind of in relation to each other somehow and stuff like that.
But we also have things like wave particle duality in there, which are quite complicated.
Yeah.
What's wave particle duality?
If you measure a subatomic particle in a certain way, it behaves like a particle, and if you measure it in another way, it behaves like a wave. So the classic experiment that sort of demonstrates this, I think, is the double slit experiment. So you fire a particle through two slits, and if you don't detect which slit it goes through, but just put a photographic plate the other side of it, then it forms an interference pattern, as if each particle that you send through is acting like a wave, and it's effectively like each particle is passing through both slits at once, interfering with itself, and then landing up on the plate at the other side. But if you put a little detector to measure which slit the particle goes through, that interference pattern disappears, and you just get two sort of lumps either side of each one of the slits. Mm. So it's like particles behave different ways depending on how you look at them.
Yeah, and I guess that was the thing that we wanted to say about people, is like people that, and this might be deeply wrong for science, but we wanted to make the comparison that people too behave different ways depending on how you look at them, how you interact with them.
Yeah.
It's all sort of shifting and indefinite.
Yeah. And people can be more than one thing.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. Do you go kind of out of your way to explain the science in the show?
We have. Well, so there's a bit at the start of the show where we do like a little demonstration, because it's based on this scientist, Smithy, who's trying to write a speech to explain what he does to the general public.
So we imagine he's like a PhD student, and as part of his PhD, he has to do some science communication. So that's like the device that allows him to talk to the audience directly and practice his speech with them.
Yeah, and so he starts by, and he's testing out this speech on his colleague, Sarah, who's also in the lab with him. And so he starts by like a demonstration with some spinning plates of electrons going around the nucleus in the atom. So we kind of start with that as a kind of basis to get people a bit into thinking about what subatomic particles are and stuff like that. Basically, we did lots of research, and so did, and we had a director as well, Susanna, who studied chemistry at university.
But her research for this show was not to read anything.
Yes.
So we had to be able to explain to her in words everything that we wanted to say in the show, which was really hard.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
and we had a week at Salisbury Arts Centre, which was like a research and development week,
yeah,
where we did all these improvisations. So we played scientists, we played particles,
historical figures.
Historical figures, like, yeah, tried to tell different stories. And then during that week, we kind of tried to narrow it down a bit about what was the interesting thing, what was relatable to you by the, like, a general audience sort, yeah, of thing.
And then after that, we had a five-week rehearsal period. In the first 2 weeks at Salisbury Arts Centre, Susanna and Tiff were there with us. So we improvised scenes, the same kind of thing, but more structured. And by the end of that 2 weeks, we all sat down and we said, so this is the story, it's going to be like this. And we knew scene by scene what was going to happen. And we had made videos, rough outline videos of each scene. Then Tiff went away and wrote for 3 weeks. And then we came back and we worked at the Pound Arts Centre in Corsham for 3 weeks. And that was like the rehearsal period. So we had the script. She was adapting it every night, which seemed intense because we just stopped in the evening and she worked, yeah, after us. So she'd adapt it and then we'd re-rehearse in the morning.
Yeah.
But the fun thing was she was there with her son, Seb. So we had a little baby in the rehearsal room,
cool,
which was amazing. And it was really nice because as soon as anyone got stressed out, he would get upset. So we'd have to sort of, you know, not hold that stress in the room,
yeah,
in,
yeah,
that kind of way. And we knew if the show was good because he would watch it. And if he didn't, he'd get bored and distracted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And is that a kind of normal writing process for you guys?
I think it's the way we like to work.
Yeah.
Because I guess we sort of, we think good work comes from everyone having an input, like the performers as, mm, well as the writer and the director. And we think a collaborative approach like, yeah, that works quite well, yeah, for us.
But we also think that having a director as a final line and a writer to try and make you say more intelligent stuff is really good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because have you worked without a director?
Yes, and without, yeah, a writer. Right. And that's really hard.
It's very hard, yeah.
Okay. Because I made a theatre show, or I produced a theatre show recently in my camper van. We turned the camper van into
a
command module from Apollo 11. It's very cool. Yeah. It's the first time I've worked in theatre, and it's I was kind of fascinated to see just how important that director role is, actually.
Mm.
Just to have somebody else looking at it and going, yeah, no, this is, yeah, this is working, this isn't working, you take it this way and that. It's just really, really helpful.
Yeah, because, yeah, it's so hard to feel or see what's happening from the inside.
Yeah.
And to see all the options as well. Like, you feel like when you're in it, you're like, oh, it's going to be this one. And then they're like, no, actually, hey,
yeah,
check out this possibility,
yeah,
as,
yeah,
well.
Are you going to keep doing the show after this, the tour? Are you going to tour it again?
Yeah, I think so. Probably for Science Week next year in, okay, March.
Yeah.
That's the plan.
Where will that be happening?
We don't know yet, but
that's the horrible next job.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
But next year's tour.
Yeah.
Were you interested in science before? Is that why you did? Why did you do this?
This is kind of my fault, really, because, yeah, I studied physics at A level,
oh, okay,
and I really loved it. It was like my favourite subject, and then I sort of decided to do drama instead, and always sort of regretted not doing science more.
Right. Okay.
So I thought, why not try and combine the two passions and try and make a play about physics? Maybe about a couple of years ago, we decided, okay, this is the time to try and do it.
Yeah.
Because we lived in France for 7 years and we just moved back to the UK about 2 years ago. So we thought, this is the moment, let's try and do a science show.
Where did you live in France?
We both went to theatre school in Paris and then stayed working and living there for, I guess, 4 years after each of our schools.
What different theatre schools?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which ones?
I went to the Jacques Lecoq Theatre School.
And I went to the Philippe Goulier one.
Okay.
So they're like rivals, weird, oh, right, rivals.
So you hate each other.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah. Like, that's not the technique, Kristen.
So we've had, Jacques Lecoq, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So we had some guys from there.
Yeah, Dinosaur Park or, yeah, Jurassic Park, that's, yeah, an amazing show.
Yeah, yeah, you saw show. It. Yeah.
You've seen it twice.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you don't have any kind of science background?
No, not at all. But I probably read books for a year before we made the show.
Okay.
And after that year of reading, felt quite well informed. And then since that year, feel quite ill informed.
Right, yeah.
So I had it for a second and then it vanished.
Did you write the show? Who wrote it?
We sort of had the idea that we'd like to make a show which, like, the original idea was that it compared people and particles, like the way people relate to the way particles relate. That was how we started off. And then we went in and talked to Dr. Helen Heath at Bristol University, who's a physics researcher there, and sort of chatted over some ideas. And then we thought, this is really complicated. We need to have someone intelligent to help us write this. And so we asked our friend Tiffany Woodsmith, who's a writer from London, to help us write it. So we did lots of sort of research and development, like improvisations and scenes and stuff. Yeah. And then she watched all of those and then wrote a script from what made sense out of it.
Okay. All right. Okay. So... You were reading about science. Was that specifically to start writing stuff, to start improvising stuff, or was it just to get an understanding? What was it?
I think it was all of those things, actually. I think it was first of all, we didn't know what exactly that we wanted the show to be about. We knew we wanted to do a show about science, but we didn't know what it was. So we had a fun period where it was oh my God, we could do about anything.
Yeah.
And we were oh, maybe Tesla would be really cool because he's bonkers, or I can't remember what else we thought.
Because we're near Bristol,
and
Helen told us this story about one of the physicists who used to send up balloons and would catch cosmic ray particles in the detectors that he made.
Yeah.
So that seemed like a really cool poetic idea. That was one of the options we were thinking of.
And then we kind of narrowed it down by talking with Helen and talking with Tiff, the writer, and Susanna, the director, and trying to figure out, okay, it's this. And then by the time we came to the rehearsals, I think we knew the science that we wanted to be about, and then I think we read more in detail about that specific stuff.
Yeah, which was kind of subatomic particles, how they behave, sort of wave particle duality, and also Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah.
Okay, so you probably can't remember, but what books were you reading at this time?
I do remember. Okay. I read some great ones.
Yeah.
I read three books by John Gribben. Wow. Which were amazing. I read a biography of Schrodinger, which was very nice, and it was like a wicked character in it. And then I read Schrodinger's Cat and Schrodinger's Kittens, and with those three, it was great.
Okay.
We tried reading some other stuff. I tried reading Mr. Tomlin's Journey Through the Atom, but I didn't understand that.
Okay.
And then we also read a lot of those, I don't know what they are, Cambridge University Simple Guides.
But yeah, what are they called? An introduction to particle physics or an introduction to quantum physics. Those were, I found them really good.
Oh, I found them really hard.
You had the physics A-level to fall back on, I guess. But these are quite sort of esoteric bits of physics, aren't they?
Yes.
Does it lend itself well to theatre?
No. I guess we seen some science show there are lots of different types of science shows. There's demonstration shows where you do an experiment on stage and everyone goes wow, and then there are biography shows, which there's a really good biography of Albert Einstein on at the moment,
and it's actually part of a trilogy. They have the three, they're really nice,
and that's you tell the life of the scientist
and their work,
and their work, and often one says something about the other and stuff.
Yeah.
And we were I wanted to try and do something different.
Yeah.
So we started off with this idea of trying to relate people and particles.
Yeah.
And we kind of wanted the story to sort of reflect the theory we wanted to talk about in its structure. And content, I guess. That was the idea. I don't know if we succeeded, but that was kind of the idea.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Science and storytelling. There are some books and stories, The Martian by Andy Weir. Mm-hmm. We interviewed Andy Weir, and he said that the science kind of drove the story.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that way around for you? Is it the other way? Is it mixed?
I think we haven't thought about it in those exact words, but I think that's the conversation that we have after every show. When we're driving home, is And sometimes it feels, I don't know, sometimes, I think it depends on the audience. Like, sometimes the show feels too science heavy for the audience. And sometimes the audience love the science and they're really happy with it. And then sometimes the science, like, gets thrown by the wayside.
Mm.
And they're in there for the story.
Because you've done the show in at science festivals.
Yeah,
you've
that's
done it in
right.
normal theatres.
Mm. Yeah.
Can you see a difference between those audiences?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Partly the jokes that people laugh at. Like, we've got a lot of, like, I guess physics in jokes.
Yeah.
And at science festivals, everyone's there, like, sniggering at Planck's constant getting mentioned. Or, like, I don't know, just... or any mention of Schrodinger, like, stealing cats or anything like that is really funny for people at science festivals. And a general audience less so.
Right.
Yeah.
But we also have lots of, like, falling over and hitting each other and that sort of stupid thing.
Yeah.
Which hits more a general audience,
and also
audience,
breaking out, and this is what we're trying to do at the moment, is we're trying, because we really like a direct interaction with the audience, like declaring when you make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're trying to do at the moment is find the spaces in the show without, like, destroying the adventure journey, so that people still care about the characters, they still want the cat to be found, etc. But there's moments when we declare, oh, sorry about that, guys, or, you know, what? I think that was your line.
that kind of
stuff.
Okay. Have you done any other science plays or work at all?
Nope. This is the first one we've had a go at.
Well, if it's the first, is it the last? Are you going to do more?
Oh, I don't know. So in the show, I play Proton and Tristan plays Electron. And it's really fun. Like, I've got a big red, like, chubby suit on, like a big red pillow with a big plus, and he's got like a skinny onesie and a bum bag filled with photons. So we kind of imagine, we have real fun to play them, so we keep imagining like a spin-off that is really educational, but with these two characters and like a host of other particles that all come on.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we were like, we could spend the rest of our lives making shows about science. I'm not sure if that's the right thing to do, but...
Well, I think it's the right thing.
It's like we just opened the door and there's mass loads.
Yeah.
That you could...
So any of those ideas that you were kind of throwing around at the beginning could come back, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and I'd be really up for doing a sort of medieval science play about, like, alchemy.
Oh, yeah, and how like, the understanding of science has developed through the ages. That could be really, like, the history of science in 1 hour or something like that.
Because the other thing we were thinking about was doing a play about the understanding of the atom. Like, starting in Greek times, I can't remember the name of the guy who first used the word, like, atomos.
Democritus or something like that.
Yeah, and how... But then we're like, actually, it hasn't changed that much. These silly ideas in the middle, and now we're back with that one.
But do you know why people are coming to see the show? What is it that they're...
I think the science.
Yeah,
in Bristol.
I think a lot of people are interested in this Schrodinger's cat idea.
Yeah.
Because it's... I don't know, it's a thing people have heard of. And I think lots of people are curious about what it is and how it works and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Sydney and Tristan, thank you so much for joining me here in the Cosmic Shed. And the best of luck with the show.
Well, thanks very much for having us.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So I really enjoyed chatting to Tristan and Sydney in the shed. And after the show, there was a Q&A with quantum computing physicists from the University of Bristol. I just wanted to bring you a couple of their responses to the questions that they were asked there.
So I'm Alasdair. I work in quantum cryptography.
I am Ewan. I work at the Centre for Quantum Photonics in Bristol with Alasdair. My work mainly focuses on quantum computing.
These seem to me to be quite sort of theoretical things, but you're actually physically doing something. So what are you actually physically doing, and what does a quantum computer look like now?
The quantum computers we're building in Bristol are actually... So they're based on light, so you have... All your bits are photons, and our one or zero, or our qubit, is whether a photon, single particle of light, is in one way, one path or another path. If it's in this path, it's a zero. If this path, it's a one. We can actually get it into a superposition of being both in this path and this path at the same time, and that's actually done through something called a beam splitter. So, classically, if you have, it's just a half silvered mirror. So, if you shine a beam on it, half of it would go this way, and half of the laser would go this way. If you shine a single photon on this, then actually it doesn't just end up one half the time going this way and half the time going this way. It actually goes into a superposition of being in both of the paths. So that's how we generate superposition. And the kind of technology we're building on is something called silicon photonics. So it's based in silicon, the same kind of fabrication technology and stuff that's used for classical computer chips now. So the same thing that's in everybody's laptop at home. But we can build what are basically optical fibers, so paths that the photon will stay in, and you can guide this photon around the chip. And all we're doing is trying to get lots of single photons, which is really hard, actually. That's the challenge, is getting lots of single photons to come into this thing at the same time, and we guide them around, and we bring them together to do some gates require 2 qubits to meet, or we put them on beam splitters, and they go all the way to the end, and then you detect them. And assuming that you've done the computation, which is performed by these paths, then your detection at the end tells you something useful about that computation. And the way we change the computation is we apply heaters to different parts of the chip, and that changes the property of the photon, which changes sometimes which path it goes through. So it's actually, yeah, that's how it's made. And we have big experiments, big in terms of the number of components they have, but they actually fit onto a chip that's, the paths that they're going down are 500 nanometers across, so they're about a thousandth of a human hair. So they're small.
For quantum communications, you can use the same sort of silicon technologies that Ewan's described to actually generate your quantum states and to manipulate them. One of the big things, though, is that instead of creating a source of single particles of light, with quantum cryptography, you can basically take a laser and lower the power to the point where you've got about one particle of light every so often. And with sort of various extra modifications, that can still be secure. Now, what are we actually doing with that? We're putting out into the real world now, because as we said before, sort of in the next 10 years, we need to have this stuff in place. So around Bristol, we have basically a 4-node network called Bristol is Open, and that's not a quantum network in itself. That's something which a lot of classical guys have set up. But I'm going around putting quantum cryptography onto this network. And in fact, yesterday I was out at Bradley Stoke as well, extending this network out, because the aim is to try and get it out to London. And then we're meeting Toshiba, who are coming down from Cambridge, to create a UK backbone quantum cryptography network. Quantum cryptography requires less states, less different sort of combinations, zeros and ones, than computing. So in that sense, it's a slightly simpler technology, and that's why we can get that out there now. Whereas with quantum computing, it's still got a little way to go.
Yeah, so maybe I'll just emphasise, like, the QKD stuff in Bristol is happening right now, and eventually it's going to be publicly available, I think, to access.
Yes. In theory, by the end of this year. In practice,
if Alistair,
just to emphasise how difficult this is. We had it all working. I've done quantum cryptography, sort of bouncing off different nodes across the city, and then we took it out yesterday. Did a lot of measurements. It all looked fine. Plugged it all in, and then a university firewall stopped me from doing it. So it's not just the quantum side to work, it's getting it to actually fit in with everything that already exists. And that's happening right now, and everything else is sort of building up to the point where it can be deployed.
And there are, so the Centre for Quantum Photonics, the group we're part of, online, if you Google us, you can have access to an old chip, so you can actually have access to a very small quantum computer, and you can run your own computations on it if you want. It's 2 qubits, so it's very, very small. It's just 2 photons. We're going to publish soon quantum, it's called Quantum in the Cloud, Quantum in the Cloud 2.0, which is a 6-qubit machine, which is probably the most advanced thing we've done so far. It's going to be out hopefully in the next half a year, and that's going to be publicly available as well. So this is real technology that we're really producing now. It's just, at the moment, at least for computation, it's very small and kind of just proving that we can do it and working and building this thing bigger, but it's accessible to everyone.
How big will my quantum Xbox be?
There's many physical systems that you could maybe build a quantum computer in. We're focusing on light. I described it as being very small, and it is for the moment, but actually the detectors we need require cryogenics for the moment, so they need to work at very low temperatures, and that means that all of a sudden you have a a cryostat, so a thing to keep that thing cool, which is probably the size of me, maybe four of me, so it's very big. Almost all platforms at the moment require cryogenics, and will probably be the first quantum computer that does something that we can't do already, I think, will be the size of a room, I think. The idea with the platform we're working on is that eventually we'll work out how to do detection without cryogenics, and this thing will be very small and will integrate very nicely with your laptop or your Xbox. So at the moment I think it's going to very much follow actually the footprints of classical computing, in that it's going to be very big, and companies, very large corporate companies like Google, Microsoft, IBM, they're going to be the people that have these machines, and maybe you can access them through the internet, the cloud, and then eventually we'll find a way of compacting these things down to maybe the point where you can have one in your home. But at the moment also we don't have many algorithms that would really warrant, there's maybe a few algorithms that would warrant you having one in your home, but at the moment a lot of the applications are very industry, business focused. So yeah, I don't know.
Well, there you have it. I think there's an awful lot we can say about quantum mechanics, quantum physics, and I just think we've got to do an episode on it. Quantum Leap, I reckon. If you'd like to hear more from The Cosmic Shed, you can visit thecosmicshed.com. You can follow us on Twitter at The Cosmic Shed, find us on Facebook, and we'll be back very soon with another episode. I'm afraid our Wrath of Khan screening for the live Cosmic Shed in Bristol Planetarium is sold out. So you can't join us for that. Obviously, we'll bring you the audio from it. There are about, as I record, I think there are about 10 tickets left for the first contact screening that we're doing again in the planetarium. So you can snap those up quickly. There's a link on the Cosmic Shed website. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.